everybody. Welcome back to the show. Before we get into the introduction to the guests and all the content today, I want to share with you some really exciting news. I have decided, in the spirit of the sport of leadership and the leadership athlete, which I'm wearing on my t-shirt, we are changing the name of the show. So for about 5 years, it's been This with Shauna Griffiths. And going forward, it is Game with Shauna Griffiths, Conversations with Impactful Leaders. So we're bringing all the same content related to real talk with real leaders. We're going to break down hot topics, and we're going to draw some more parallels again between business and life, and the fact that leadership itself is a sport that I think. So let's get to today's guest, who is the perfect guest for me to share this announcement with you all. He has been an incredible leader and impactful leadership athlete who I've known from afar before I got to know directly. So I'm grateful for that. Welcome, Andrew Schwartz. Thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you for including me in such a special day as you change paths with your show.
Yeah, thank you. So folks, I'll give you a little bit of a clue to Andrew's past and how I really believe that he is an impactful leadership athlete, and then we'll turn it over to him a bit. So he has been a prolific leader in the business of sports and entertainment and real estate. You'll add the ones that I missed as we go along here. He is revered, truly revered, just adored by some of the people that I respect the most in my careers. Fred Mangione, who is he's like an icon in the sports and in entertainment industry. Freddie, as so many of us call him. Elisa Padilla, another icon. She has received numerous awards for her incredible marketing efforts. She is now the CMO of the Red Bulls, who just had an awesome run in the playoffs in MLS. And folks, when you ask about Andrew, here's the comments that you get. He's a gem. He's the best. And one of the ones I love the most, which we'll get into later, is he's one of the good ones. So the last thing I will share is, if people are new to the show and you're not too sure what I'm talking about with leadership athlete reference, so it's a mindset that I coined with this concept, the word, the leadership athlete. So it represents the thing that you see in high performing athletes a lot of times. You also see them in ways like Andrew, you know, is a high performing leader in life and in business. So things like being coachable, being resilient, being committed to something that's bigger than just yourself, embracing responsibility and accountability. We'll come back to some of that as we talk to Andrew today. And knowing the impact that it makes when you play your role. So a couple of other things is that you are constantly working to make yourself better than ever yesterday, that you're making other people better around you, which Andrew promised me he would help me get over my nerves today and make me feel better. So thank you. You're already showing me that. Being adaptable, curious, putting in the work every day, like practicing. And the last part is just this willingness to learn, grow, and evolve. So with all of that, Andrew, I would love for you to give us a bit of a snapshot of what you've done in your career. I know most recently you were co-president of the Howard Hughes Corporation. You've been with some of the biggest sports entities, the Brooklyn Nets, MLB, NHL, and on and on. You'll kind of lead in here. So I'll stop there. So give us kind of a snapshot of you in business.
Thanks for the intro. Yeah. One day, if I'm lucky enough to be in some hall of fame somewhere, please just repeat that as part of my induction ceremony.
Yeah, thank you
for that. And I thank those who said such nice things about me. So yeah, I'm excited to be here and to share my career journey and some of the tidbits that you had touched on earlier. I would say that early on, I got into sports. I was actually in the mid-90s, my mom answered a classified ad in what's called a newspaper, which is this paper thing that's got ink on it. And a professional roller hockey team was looking for someone to be an intern and stuff some envelopes. I realized that when my mom told me I was going to be having this job, that would be my start in sports. I was stuffing envelope for a ticket sales guy named Fred Mangione, who was working for a roller hockey upstart that was going to make big waves, introducing a new sport into the world of the Big Four and take over the universe. It didn't quite work out that way, but it was my first start. So early on, I was in high school. I had internships in sports from the very beginning, and that sort of evolved. I went to the University of Connecticut. I am a hockey guy. We'll talk about that in a second. I thought I'd have a Rudy moment by trying out for the men's team and making it and having some, you know, penalty shot goal in the championship and winning it all. But frankly, I just wasn't good enough to make the team, which is fine. I asked where there were volunteer opportunities within the organization for the athletic department, and I got put in touch with the head coach of the women's ice hockey team, and I volunteered there for a little while, picking up pucks, filling water bottles, that sort of thing. Quickly, I think she realized it was a little bit more value to me in that particular scenario when she asked me to be a student assistant coach. So that was my first real chance to be a leader, if you will, and step up. And in the morning, if you will, being in class with some of these young women, and then later on in the afternoon or on the weekends, being their coach was a very interesting dynamic. And we'll talk more about that in a second, where I have to switch the mindset and they have to recognize me in two very particular roles. Come my senior year, the head coach actually left very late into the summer and they didn't have time to fill the role. So I spoke to the athletic director, and as a senior at the University of Connecticut, I assumed the role of head coach of the women's ice hockey program at the University of Connecticut and helped Pat Babcock at the time transition them to Division 1A, which was a big moment for me. Graduated college, went to go do an internship, left the hockey coaching at the University of Connecticut. They found someone much more qualified than I was at the time. Went to go work at the NHL, where I was an intern in the events and entertainment department. After that, I went to work for the Office of the Commissioner of Major League Baseball, similarly in the events and entertainment department for a couple of years. And then halfway through, I switched and went to the corporate sales and marketing department. I did have a 2-year stop in between the NHL and Major League Baseball, and that was working for the New Jersey Devils, where I was in community development and working with the alumni and what they call a game presentation, which in your interview is just like, oh yeah, you're going to help out during the game, throw some t-shirts, etc. But when you actually show up and they give you a 40-pound New Jersey Devil mascot costume, and you realize that you are now actually a professional mascot, and you will be for those 2 years that you worked there, it was a different sort of game entertainment than I originally anticipated. So NHL, Devils, Major League Baseball, finished up in corporate sales and marketing, and then went to run SiriusXM sports marketing business. Did that for 4 years. Halfway through that, I changed from sports marketing to more of the ad sales side of things to get a little bit more experience under my belt in terms of the sales side of things. I quickly transitioned out of that role and went to go work for the New Jersey Nets at the time, our Netties on 390 Murray Hill Parkway in East Rutherford, I think it was. Part of the executive leadership team that built the sponsorship business that was going to come to life at Barclays Center for the imminent move to Brooklyn, helped the team move to Brooklyn, spent a few years there. Helped craft the New York Islanders sponsorship business as we helped run that out of Nassau Coliseum and then bring them over to Brooklyn. And then got a call one day from a real estate development company that was looking to change the landscape of New York City, literally and figuratively. It was the Howard Hughes Corporation. They bought the historic South Street Seaport, as it was called at the time, and they were putting $1 billion+ into redeveloping that neighborhood, and they needed someone to build a sponsorship business. And I was brought on to do that. There was an evolution of my role within there, but I imagine we'll get to that as we talk.
Well, what a remarkable journey. And so folks, part of that is opening up facilities, creating new brands, developing entire new fan bases. And I actually spent quite a bit of time at the New Jersey Nets at 390. And so, but Andrew and I didn't really overlap and work together. So it's been just so great to sort of connect again over time and after hearing about you so much. And so I'm glad that you talked about, you gave the your experience, how that came to bear in hockey. And I think for the listeners, I think one of the things that I've loved as I've gotten to know you and heard about you is the way you've transitioned so much that you've taken from hockey, like fundamentals from this sport that you love and respect, and you've transferred them into the way that you lead. And I think that, you know, in saying that, you're like a testament to this theory that I have that like leadership is a sport. So folks, this is the ice hockey edition of this theory. You know, today, so we talked about all the stuff that you've done, and we'll get into more of the leadership stuff in a minute, but I want to get to what you're doing now, which is as principal of 5-Minute Game, of your business, your consultancy business. Tell us kind of what sparked you to do that, and what are you doing with that business?
Yeah. So when I left Seaport in June after nine great years of leading a bunch of different teams there, I took a step back for a minute, as most people do in this career transition space. And I've done it before, leaving one industry and going to another. So it was really just like, what industry could I step into next and make an impact, be an impactful leader? And I looked in the mirror and I said, you know what? I've been doing this with teams for a really long time. You know, what kind of role can I play within other organizations to be a teammate with a consultancy role that can come in and come out? So I started this business called Five in a Game, which is a hockey reference, really big surprise. And every team that's built understands that, you know, the greater success and the bigger picture comes with teams that understand that collaboration and commitment to that bigger picture is what drives that success. And that's in business and in sports, it's this collective achievement. And it's built with individuals who know their roles, they embrace their responsibilities, and they work tirelessly to elevate the team. It's always about the team. So in hockey, there are first liners who are playmakers. They're visionaries who create opportunities for others. They rise to the challenge. They deliver these extraordinary moments that you see on the NHL network. They're all about precision and passion. And for them, there's no job that's too tall. They're ready for that challenge. Also, there are fourth liners on hockey teams. And those guys are the grinders. They're resilient, relentless players who do the gritty work. They deliver the monster checks, they disrupt opponents, and they literally stand up when it matters most, and they fight for their teammates. They embody grit and tenacity. And for them, there's no job too small, as they only play a couple of minutes a game. So at Five in a Game, we sort of honor both of those mindsets, the first line mindset and the fourth line mindset. We are role players. We put the we before me, whether the task is, you know, big or small. We sort of embrace it with the pride, knowing that that collective achievement and elevating the team is the primary goal. And we work with organizations that need a role player. And it could be a CEO advisory role where someone is looking for a little bit of a different voice to bounce something off of. It could be another real estate development company that's thinking big, like Howard Hughes Corporation was thinking big. They want to understand how to program their spaces, how to commercialize their spaces through partnerships, and how to connect better to the community to make sure that they're engaging those who are most important to their success. So it's really a little bit all over the place, but in a really good way. And I think it sort of reflects back on my Howard Hughes time, where I started just doing the sponsorship. And every year or so, I picked up another piece of the business until I was the co-president at the end. And the mindset is very similar. What role can I play in any particular moment for these companies, these developers, these teams, these brands, these CEOs, and help fill in any missing gaps?
Yeah, it sounds amazing. It sounds like you're really focused on that kind of bolt on for now, get someone really like ramped up and set them up for success, and then they can, you know, go on. And so it's great to hear about, because it really does allow you to maximize the contribution that you can make and that impact you're making from what I can see. When you're talking about hockey, I wrote it down so I would remind myself that I didn't forget it. So I went to a University of Michigan hockey game at some point this year. Brother-in-law David Harlock played hockey for Michigan, played in the NHL, was in the Olympics for Canada, won silver. So went with him. I really don't know much about hockey. I'm so sorry, Drew. But I'm watching, and I was actually just amazed by the short amount of time that the players get out on the ice. And just what you were saying, it struck me as you were saying, because it's the element of get out there, that role playing, right? And so if you're a coach or you're a leader, you want to help make sure that the people are set up for success to play the roles they're supposed to. And in the moments where they have to almost like play out of position, play a different role, you also want to do your best to set them up for success in that. Because as much as you want people all the time to be operating in their sweet spot in their role, chances are we all have to play out of position at times. So I don't know if there's anything that sparks for you to say, but when you were saying it, I was just thinking back to that game I was watching.
Yeah, immediately it goes to sort of the way that I've tried to lead in my career. And that is, you don't need to be in everybody's stuff all the time. You need to get out there for 35 to 45 seconds. You need to play the role that the team needs you to play in any particular moment. Sometimes it's working on social strategy. Sometimes it's taking a meeting and sit shoulder to shoulder with your salesperson who's pitching a big CMO and not talking, but just being there to support. So if you get in and you get out, the team feels like they've got someone that they can rely on, and you can jump on 8 or 10 or 20 times a game, or you can come out there the one time somebody needs to beat the crap out of somebody, go sit in the penalty box for 5 minutes in a game misconduct, hence the name of the company, and then move on.
Yeah, that's perfect. And when you were describing that, actually, I will share this. Elisa shared this with me, is that you're known for, I think she said it, where you're empower the people, your teammates or the people that work for you, to be experts in the room. So, and I bring that up at this moment because the way you just described how you stand shoulder to shoulder with your teammate in the room that day, and you know, you may not have a speaking role. You may not be dominating the conversation that stereotypically a lot of people in a top leadership seat will do. So talk to us about your theory about empowering people to be the experts in the room.
Yeah, well, I'll work it in reverse. If you're not giving anything to the meeting or getting anything out of the meeting, get up and leave the meeting. And that should be something that you talk to your boss about, and they would recognize right off the bat that you want to be as valuable as possible to the organization. And I think there's some respect that can be had there with your leaders. But yeah, I think that when you sit in a room with a bunch of people and as the leader, you kick things off and start talking, blah, 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 it totally changes the dynamic of the room, because then everybody is fixated on complementing the things that you said and changing their mindset and their strategy to meet what you've said. If you sit back and you're the last person to talk, and one of my mentors told, you know, helped me understand this, you recognize the value of everybody in the room, their different positions and what they bring to the table. And if they truly are the experts and they're collaborating with each other, they're going to bring out what they believe is the best solution to the problem you're trying to solve. And if you trust them and they are the experts in the room, then you take the expert opinion of all of these different leaders. And when it comes down to the really hard decision that needs to be made, that a boss needs to make, you have all of the best information possible. You're not throwing out a thesis and then everybody's adjusting their plan of attack to meet that thesis. You're writing the thesis as you go, and you're helping the people in the room add to it, feel empowered by it, and then go and run their business.
Yeah. Absolutely. When you were talking about it, also just the things that came to my mind is that allows you as the leader, the air quotes boss, as you said, in the room to actively listen, to be in that mode, to have the what you just described show so much self-awareness and intentionality from you, specifically you, Andrew, but also just for people who are listening to this, it's a different approach to how you're going to step into that room and impact the environment of that room. I love the way you said that you're not, you know, throwing out a thesis that everybody else is adjusting to try to please you because or compliment you. I think that, you know, even if you have great staff who don't necessarily think that way about being people pleasers, I think at the end of the day, their dynamic is the fact that you're the boss in the room. So, you know, people do want to, again, a lot of times people want to just be in sync with that.
Yeah. And the best and worst part about it is if you do it in the way that I've outlined, the people who are the experts in the business have to stand up and they have to communicate their perspective to their teammates. And then their teammates have the ability to get a sense of their view on the project. If you say something that is counter to what one of your teammates may want to say, now, not only are they feeling discouraged about what they believe was the right path, but then they're not going to talk. And then their face is going to be very stoic. They're not going to be participating in the meeting. That then becomes contagious and other people start to quiet down. And then you don't have the room that you really want, which is that bench that's active, where there's encouragement, where there's excitement, where there's like, listen, if you don't pick things up, I'm going to get out there and I'm going to do it for us. But you're the guy we rely on or the girl that we rely on. Go do it. Go do it. Take that on our behalf and be the role player we need you to be in that moment. And it's the worst is when you sit in a room and you're like, So, you know, Jane, you have anything to say? You've countered all of her expert opinions before, and she's like, nope, you covered it all. That's the worst. That's the worst.
True. It is exactly that word of empowering, that helping to them to stand in their strength and build that confidence. The other element that you talked about is when you do empower those other leaders in the room, when they're the ones who are talking, it actually sends a signal to their staff, again, that you do trust them. So that just reinforces that you believe in them and that what that person is saying, leading with is valid.
Yeah. And I think that if you do trust your people, then you put them in front of your boss as the leader. And that shows value that your boss recognizes you trusted your people. You've aggregated this superstar team of role players who are all experts. And then the benefit of having your, you know, head of marketing step up in front of your board of directors when typically the intermediary would do all the talking, you lose value on both sides. You look as a leader like you're trying to capture all the excitement and deliver all the big news. And then the people who are, you know, I don't like to say below you, but the people who work for you don't feel like they have that moment in the sun. And so this trifecta of your boss and the people that you work for all seeing value in each other in the moment creates so much momentum and excitement around the project that, you know, you end up in a much better spot than if you tried to capture.
Yeah, I could not agree with you more. And I've been in those situations where I am working with the people who are, air quotes, working for me on a team and saying to them, okay, you're going to now present this to the number one person or, you know, that person above. And it is something, the reason why I'm pointing it out is because sometimes it's interesting what that person's response to. What I've often found is there's a bit of like, wait, what? You know? And so even in that, it's working with that person to make sure that they are, it's that communication, the trust you're building with them, that they feel more empowered and able to do that because you're literally setting them up for success. You're like, okay, this is, I want you to be able to make it your own, be authentic in the way that you do that. And here's some tips. You know, that's where I think so much like the coaching comes into play.
Yeah. And I think that if you dive even deeper to the year-end review and the compensation cycle and asking for money, and asking for bonus because, you know, a closed mouth doesn't get fed. If I'm the intermediary and I'm trying to explain what, you know, someone on my team does to someone above me, and I don't do as good of a job in that particular moment of explaining how valuable that person is to our team, then the raise and the bonus that you're looking for is much harder to get. But if I give you that direct connectivity to the people who make those much bigger financial decisions, I can help you get to where you want to be. I can help you grow. So understand that it's in the moment. I want you to feel like you're empowered and that you run your business, but it's also give you the visibility to those who make really important decisions about our compensation. So they know exactly who you are. And if you put on a great show in that presentation, there'll be no question about your value. And my request for a 10% bonus or a this or that is much easier. So recognize the long-term value, whether you're nervous or not, of stepping up and creating that connectivity to the senior, the most senior of senior leaders.
Yes. And when you were saying that, it got me thinking about, see, this is, folks, what we're talking about when it's like, what is your style of leading the people and the business? So what you described is, and you referenced growing the people. And so it is taking that specific interest in, you and I were talking about this the other day, like, Andrew, where do you want to go with your career? What do you want to do? How much money do you want to make? You told me a story about that, you know? And so if you're leaders who are listening, if you're taking this growth first approach with your staff and paying attention to that, they start to see the value is in that, that you actually want them to grow and make more money. I remember telling several people throughout my leadership career when I was working on the corporate side that I really actually wanted them to make more money. And sometimes, again, at first it was this look of like, are you kidding me? Are you really, you know? So this is where we can really make a difference. And I think that's part of why this philosophy, why your approach works. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that. Like, why do you think it works?
Well, I think working backwards, the people start to speak on your behalf, and therefore you can recruit and then retain the best of the best. And if you have the best of the best, it's easy to advocate for them. It's easy for you to want them to make a lot of money and to get a lot of opportunity and to change roles, which I've done along the way. And for me, the recognition in the moment that there are people who really starve for guidance and starve for opinion, valued opinion and thoughtful opinion is super important. So as I look at, you know, the teams that I've created in the past, my willingness to put them first, and you know, I mean it only for their particular growth, is with a thoughtful approach. And it's a similar approach that my mentors gave me. And I'm not suggesting that, you know, it's always the right way for everyone, because there are some people who are very comfortable being the cog in the machine that does their job and plays their role, and they want to be where they are. And thank you for the opportunity. I'll continue to deliver 110%, to use a cliche, but I don't really want that next level. I want to be where I am. And if you can recognize that in the moment, you slot that person into their role and you've got them in your team, and then you fill the gaps in around them. And if you continue to lead like that, the other people will be able to convey that message to those who are coming on board, which is a big reason why I don't interview alone. I always interview in groups. Now, I make sure that my leaders, whether they're subject matter experts in what role we're particularly hiring, or they have nothing to do with that, they're going to have to trust each other. So I make sure that everybody's a part of that process and a group decision is made. And of course, there are hard decisions to be made and somebody has to make the last one. And I'm okay in most instances being that, but being as informed as possible with those who sit around those people and that team that you've built is a much more valuable spot to be in.
It makes so much sense the way you describe that. Even that last part about there are times when you accept and choose to take that top spot as a leader, that you do have to take the bullet, make those hard decisions. And hopefully they feel less hard because you're informed and you've tapped into others to become more informed. But I think that's part of what's inherent in the responsibility of being a leader, is that it's not this self-preservation at all costs, not the kind of leadership that I want to be and that I'm seeing in you, leader I want to be, that is. So again, I think I can't emphasize enough, you know, the importance of that is sometimes you're going to have to make those hard decisions and take a bullet yourself. Yeah.
And it is more than okay. It's actually encouraged to make mistakes.
Yes.
If you aren't making mistakes, you aren't pushing the boundaries of your business, and you aren't asking your team to do more than they ever had before. And when you make mistakes, deliver the bad news as quickly as possible to your boss. Do not sit on it. Not only does it become, you know, more of a heartburn for you internally, but it slows everything else down. And the quicker you get the bad news out, the more valued your thoughts and opinions are, because you're addressing the problems in the room quickly. Then therefore, the more trust you get from your leader, because they believe you will always elevate the problems when you have them, and the mistakes that you make can get solved quicker. And it just creates this tremendous momentum internally if you're not afraid to make those mistakes.
It's such a great point that leadership, the kind of leadership we're talking about, folks who are listening, this is not about being perfect. And sometimes part of the beauty is letting your people know, I know I'm not perfect and I am going to make mistakes. I'm going to do the best I can to hold myself responsible and accountable and hopefully shield people. I remember Freddie used to talk about that. Fred Mangione, folks, who I mentioned earlier, I think we both did. You know, but I just think it's just an important point. And then the other thing that I think is interesting is you were saying the bad news first. So Leo Erlein, who is another icon in the New York sports marketplace. So he was a leader at the New Jersey Nets when I was there. And oh God, Andrew, I made some big mistakes. I had millions of pocket schedule printed with the wrong dates. I had a billboard put up with no like URL, no phone number, a billboard. And I remember one of those faux pas, Leo said to me, Shauna, I'm telling you, bad news first. Three words, four words that I absolutely have lived by in my career and I have shared with other people. So thank you. It's such a great point that, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, quote, on the rung, your seniority, it's always best to just get it out of the way. Tell people, don't bury the lead of the story.
Tell me something that gets better by not talking about it. Tell me bad news that gets better. I would love to see bad news that gets better.
Exactly. And Fred used to say to me, Shauna, we will get through anything together. And that's another thing that I think is so indicative of the type of leader that we're talking about, because it's not like, well, you screwed up, figure it out on your own. I felt so safe. I felt safe to fail, but I also wanted to impress him. I wanted to do the best that I could for him and my team. But I knew that if I did screw up because I'm human, that we were going to get through it together. So, you know, folks, I think we're sharing some of these things and we hope that they land for you and you're able to, you know, consider how can you integrate some of these things into your leadership practice.
Yeah, 100%.
So one of the things that you and I talked about the other day is that in the role that you had as co-president of the Howard Hughes Corporation, by day, you were working with very senior people, leading them, leading huge projects, literally changing the footprint, the face of New York City. And many times at the end of the day, whatever time that was, and you'll have to talk about that a little bit, you went and coached children's hockey, kids hockey, what you'll leave the age group. But we talked about that you found a real almost parallel there and some really interesting points. Can you talk a bit about that? Share with the audience what you found so interesting.
Sure. Yeah, I know everybody's going to be surprised that we're going to have a hockey story now. So, you know, obviously you sit in these boardrooms and you have these conversations with, you know, adults who are, you know, 22 to 60 or 70 years old, most of which, especially in the role of co-president, all of which report to you or sit within your organization and on your teams. And they are starving for advice and guidance and the opportunity to present and their moment in the sun. But also, if you're confident as a teammate, to know, you know, what you could be doing better. And they would ask for that. Like, tell me how I can be a little bit better. Tell me how I can get that promotion. What's my path to a little bit more of this or a little bit more of that? And how do I sit in your shoes one day? Which, by the way, terrific. I can't wait to build leaders that take, you know, my job and our jobs in the future. But they all wanted that one thing. They wanted that vision into what they can be doing to push the team to the next level. Adults. Then I've got like 9-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, who in a totally different manner and in a totally different environment actually want the same exact thing, but they don't know how to convey that request to their coach. But they also want to know, what could they be doing better? What little changes that they can make? How can they move from the fourth line to the third line to the first line, et cetera? Become the grinder to the superstar playmaker. So by day, I try and, you know, craft my message accordingly to those adults who I'm fortunate enough to have on my team. And by night and on the weekends, I'm literally with 9 and 10-year-olds and now a 13-year-old who are trying to do the same exact thing. They just live in slightly different worlds. So being able to take the same mindset and just translate the message slightly different so that it resonates with the different groups created a simplicity to leadership, because it was the same message. It was just about the delivery, how you conveyed success to, you know, your teammates in the workplace and how you conveyed success for your kids on the ice. It was the same message, but it just needed a slightly different delivery. And whether you're reporting up or you're reporting down, understanding your audience, recognizing what message, will resonate most and how to deliver that message. Sometimes it's just in an email if you know someone's super busy. Sometimes you have to get that one-on-one. Sometimes it's bad news that you need to break in front of a larger audience. Depending on what that message is and what the mechanism for delivery is, as long as it's crafted for the audience that, you know, is at hand, you'll be in really good shape.
It's so important the way you, again, explain that connection between leadership and sport. So folks, again, this is why I say leadership is a sport. And before we get off of this part, we've talked about how you saw that parallel in coaching, in the role of co-president, doing a variety of things. But I specifically have heard about your sort of ninja skills. I don't know what you'd call it in hockey, a hockey version of ninja, superstar skills. In integrating partnerships, into the work and the projects that you're doing. And the reason why I want to talk about this a bit is because I have such an affinity for partnerships, for alliances. I think they make so much sense. Brand, consumer brand brand, business to business alliances. You know, we've been in the sports industry, so corporate sponsorship, all of these, I think they're so incredible. And I think the parallels to sports are like totally there. So you've got, you know, this, like, you've got the coach, you've got teammates, you've got collaboration, a playbook, which is like activating the deal. And I swear you even have refs, because there's times that you have to get in there and kind of referee what's going on between the partners, or, you know, somebody activating. So talk to us about your, you know, superstar skills in partnerships.
Thank you. And you forgot about all the fans who will always boo, because you've got the fans in the sports landscape, in the arenas and on the fields and on the pitches. And then you've got the fans who visit, you know, your restaurants or your concert venues, or walk your streets and it's filthy and that sort of thing. So you definitely have the fans that are booing, and fixing those problems should be priority number one. And it doesn't always show up on the plate. So yeah, I guess I would view partnerships in a variety of ways. There's the most natural one that we think about in sports and entertainment, well, more so in sports. Big signs, branding, sponsorship fee, get eyeballs on, you know, my logo and help that convey some sort of message related to the juxtaposition of my brand and the Brooklyn Nets or the New York Islanders or the New York Rebels. Figuring that out, that's sort of one partnership. But in some environments, like at the Seaport, where I was for 9 years, you don't have big signs. It's not about the visibility of a particular brand to convey value for the customer that's there. It's about actually changing their experience while they're on site through the partnership. So we tried to find partners who made the experience of our customers, the 10 million or so people that came to Seaport every year, a little bit better because of the relationship that we had. Yes, it showed up as a sponsorship. And yes, it was an exchange of dollars for assets and for rights. But at its core was, what can you deliver to this neighborhood that will make a fan of your brand, or a fan become a fan of your brand, better in the moment because you're a partner of us at Seaport? And it's ran the gamut. So we had certain commitments to the community where we needed to activate our public spaces with programming. We did it with what I call franchises, Seaport Sound, Seaport Fit, Seaport Cinema, as you can, you know, sort of understand what those were. Those franchises needed partners to execute it. So while we had big sponsors up here, we also had little local brands, the local yoga studio, the local hospital who could bring out the nutritionist to talk to the community about eating healthy, and the local gym called Hit the Deck, which did HIIT fitness training out on, you know, the public area where the community could come together and enjoy some free fitness classes, helping to elevate the profile of the neighborhood as a place where great things happen. That's at its core and at its baseline. Then at the highest of high levels, you have a, you know, a brand like Chase, who has great relationships all over New York City and all over the country. And for us, we were trying to help them find a way to break into culinary. And we, at our core at Seaport, culinary was one of the important pillars. So we worked together. And we actually built a pop-up restaurant that was going to live, called the Seaport Food Lab, presented by Chase Sapphire. And yes, Chase Sapphire customers had early access, but the general population, the general community could also buy into these really cool dinners with which we brought chefs from all over the country. So that created a sense of programming in our retail spaces that activated the streets, and it came with the corporate, you know, air cover of a great brand to help make it happen. And then we brought in the local chefs and the chefs from all over the world that helped emphasize why the Seaport was such a dynamic place to experience new things. And again, it helped to convey our mission of welcoming New Yorkers back to the Seaport, because it had been a destination really only for tourists, but also those who have the time on their hands to come to Seaport when they're visiting New York from a tourist perspective, they could find new and exciting things in the neighborhood.
I'm so glad that you described all that you did, because I think it gave me and listeners a closer look to how you think, how you operate, the way you connect dots, the experience that you're creating, which, might I add, is very much like if it's hockey or it's basketball in the arena, that experience, the value proposition, the considering your fans, people who are either booing or cheering, you know, and sometimes a bit of both. So I think it just gave people a really good sort of look into how you operate, that business lens, that leadership athlete lens. So with that, I actually want to circle back just for a quick second related to what you're doing with 5 in a Game, because if people are hearing that and they're like, holy shit, I need a bit of what Andrew's bringing to the table. Give us an idea of the type of clients that are that you're really suited to impact.
Yeah, so I think my last role, having overseen a bunch of businesses in a historic neighborhood that had culinary, it had entertainment, it had retail, it had public programming, it had the Nike Jordan brand is based in one of our buildings. The ESPN studios that you watch get up in the morning was in Pier 17, which is a building that we own, a great relationship that we had. And there are a lot of folks who have spaces that are in inner cities and are in more rural areas. They're real estate developers who are trying to figure out how to elevate the profile of their neighborhood, not in the traditional sense. Bring something completely different to the landscape that helps create a different light that is shine on that neighborhood in any particular moment that incentivizes new people to come down. So I found myself working with other real estate developers who are looking for that same je ne sais quoi, that same like tire pump, if you will, for their neighborhood through programming, through sponsorship, and through partnerships. And that's been great so far. I've been doing a little bit of work with some nonprofits who are trying to do the same thing, create a new vision of what they are trying to convey to the public so that you have an old perspective of a legacy non-for-profit that is really doing great things. But to the younger communities, the younger neighborhoods, the younger folks, it's not as relevant. And therefore, they're trying to create some vibrancy. And then we have these small business CEOs that I work closely with who are trying to double revenue in a short period of time. And I can help craft a sales narrative, a storytelling approach to their business that helps elevate the things that are most important to the customer and put them first in the sales pitch versus thinking you know everything about what you do and just pushing that down someone's throat. It's like, let's figure out a way to explain your business in three different verticals. And then depending who the end customer is, let's change the entire narrative of our pitch, our presentation materials, our sizzle reels, et cetera, to make sure that we're tapping into what we understand is the passion point of our eventual customer. So I'm helping CEOs do that as well for small business.
Thank you so much for describing that. I just wanted to make sure that we kind of tied a bow on that almost.
Sure.
So that people
Thank
are, you.
You
know, listening, they're excited about it. So folks, when I do post this, Andrew is very active and actually responds to messages. So definitely reach out and see if Andrew can help create that surge of impact at your business. So you've been really generous with your time here today. So I just want to close here. I'm going to ask you two things. And one really has to do with something that's not lost on me at all. And it's that someone who quote unquote looks and sounds like you doesn't necessarily have to be one of the good ones. It's been thought of or seen in by many people in the industry. I think that, but one of the things that I just really respect and appreciate is that you have wanted to, you have made the moves. You when you and I talked, you said that you very consciously have become the leader that you are. And so that means that you chose different routes than other people may have and different ways of being and showing up every day for your people. And so I'm just curious, like, and this might sound silly or something, but like, what drives you? What has driven you over the years to make those choices and to be, I'll call it special.
Thank you. Early on, I set a career goal for myself, and I still am building the Andrew Schwartz career narrative so that when I get that big interview, that call, whatever, however it comes to life, the narrative is so thoughtfully executed that the message is one that is not difficult to deliver. And for those who are listening or watching, that career goal, it's okay to change, just like it's okay to make mistakes. And it's okay to move that target around a little bit as you progress in your career, because what you may find is that you found a different passion and there's a totally different career goal that you want to go and achieve. So for me, yeah, I've asked for changes in an industry. I've asked for demotions in particular roles where I knew that I didn't have the experience I would would need in that career narrative. So I asked to be put in a completely different role, take away my fancy office, take away all the glitz and glamour of the particular role that I had. Give me something a little bit in the trenches, in the cubes, in the sales pit. Help me figure that out. Trust me to learn that process so that I can continue to build my narrative and not selfishly and quietly, but talk about it all the time. I think everybody knows, who knows me, knows what my career goals are, and they help put me in a position for success. And I'm able to encourage those around me through my particular personal actions to do the same and not to be afraid to. And if you remember, it's okay to make mistakes. So along the way, it's okay to find a particular path that may not be exactly what you want and go and change the narrative. You have to be selfish in your career. You have to think about yourself and your happiness and the way you interact with those around you at home and in the workplace so that you're giving your all in both of those environments. And again, it's okay to change what that
means. Yeah, definitely, especially when you have a true intention of growing people and seeing not only that impact on the people, but also creating that impact in business. And then the two go together. And I think that one of the things that I felt really challenged in as I was coming up is I oftentimes would see those things not coming together. So again, that connection of the impact that you're making on the people and the business, because the reality is when you do that with the people and the business, I think in a large part takes care of itself. So thank you very much for sharing those things. And then the last thing then is just, are there any additional takeaways that as we wrap up here that you want to make sure that the audience has from your episode?
There are a lot of cliches in leadership. And I think that in most instances, if it weren't true, it wouldn't be a cliche. And I think there's value in that. So you have to give 110% to sound a little bit cheesy. You have to be the one who stands up and in some instances be the quiet voice in the room behind the scenes doing things. And sometimes it's being the loudest voice in the room. But for those young people who are in the office space, and I know that those are fewer and further between now that we've got this work from home environment, go knock on some doors. Go talk to people. Go find out what their personal interests are. Create connections and trust and value in the relationship with those who are around you. And it really starts at a personal level. We're often thrust into these corporate environments where we're asked to play a particular role and no one really cares about where you've been or where you want to go because you have a job to do, but you need to create some personality, some personal connectivity around that job to your teammates. Don't be afraid to walk out the door at 5 o'clock or 4:30 and say, "Hey, all, I'm leaving to go coach my daughter's soccer team. It's who I am. It's what drives me. I'll see you guys tomorrow. If you need me, you know, call my cell phone." Because then it encourages them to do the same thing, to live their life. And at the end of the day, if you're all doing that and you're finding this great balance between the two, another cliche, then you find yourself giving even more for your teammates because you want them to have the same environment that you selfishly want to have for yourself, which is being able to integrate your personal life into your workspace. So knock on some doors, find the personal connectivity with the people around you, the bosses, the people who work for you, and make sure there's something deeper than the fact that, you know, you have a particular title within a particular group at a particular organization, and that's what defines you, because that does not produce leadership. What produces leadership is recognizing the value in human beings, where they can go, what they can do, and don't be afraid to move people into different spots, as I've been moved in the past. Changing jobs to me is very exciting. Changing roles to me is very exciting. Changing industries to me is very exciting. And it's scary, 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 scary at the same time. But if you've got the trust in the people around you when you make those moves, it's a really easy transition.
Well, I couldn't thank you enough for sharing all of that, for being the guest today. As I shared, I knew that you were going to be the perfect guest to launch the new title. Again, folks, it is Game Time with Shauna Griffiths, Conversations with Impactful Leaders. And, you know, Andrew, that is 100% you. You are a shining example of a leadership athlete, and I'm honored that you came to the show today. So thank you. And thank you, folks, so much for joining. Stay tuned for the next episode.